Some people might say coffee doesn't need chocolate, but you're not some people. You're a dreamer. You see the possibilities of chocolate and caramel flavors swirling together with cold brew, topped with velvety chocolate cold foam and cocoa caramel crumbles. That imagination can only be rewarded with Dunkin's new caramel chocolate cold brew. It's a cold brew dream come true. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.
Dose of Leadership Podcast, episode 257.
Welcome to another episode of the Dose of Leadership Podcast, the show that brings you inspiring and educational interviews with today's most relevant and motivating leaders. Each episode is dedicated to highlight real-life leadership and influence experts who dedicate their lives to the pursuit of the truth, common sense, and courageous leadership. And now, here's your host, Richard Ryerson.
Hey, welcome to the show, episode 257. We've got Linda Kaplan Thaler on the show today. Great guest, great book that she's written a handful of books, but the book that we talk primarily on, the reason why I wanted her on the show, is a book that's been out for a little while, but it's called Grit to Great. And I absolutely love this book, and you need to read it if you haven't read it. It needs to be a go-to for you if you're interested in leadership, entrepreneurship, never giving up. And that is so much about leadership, isn't it? Never giving up, the tenacity, the persistence. That's the big lesson I've had from doing this show for 3 years. It always goes back to never giving up, tenacity, persistence. I love what Ralph Waldo Emerson said about persistence and tenacity. And he says, the characteristic of a genuine hero is persistency. All men have wandering impulses, fits and starts of generosity. But when you have resolved to be great, abide by yourself, and do not weakly try to reconcile yourself with the world. The heroic cannot be the common, nor the common the heroic. And I think it's so true if we want to lead this life of significance, because the whole reason why we study leadership or why we try to become better leaders, it's so that we can lead more significant lives. It impacts everything that we do. It's central to everything that we do. And it all goes back to persistence, tenacity. It's less about talent. Talent's a given. You got to be good at something, but it's the tenacity, the persistence, the grit. It's what's going to carry you through the day. Gosh, I'm so happy you're tuning in to Dose of Leadership. If you're finding some value here, please take the time to leave a rating and review on iTunes and Stitcher. The show continues to grow by leaps and bounds. It's because of your support. And if you're brand new to the show, I appreciate you tuning in to Dose of Leadership. And again, subscribe to it onto your smart device, on your phone, on your iPhone, your Android phone, and leave that rating review at iTunes and Stitcher. It helps so much for the visibility of the show. And if you are finding some value, you can go to Patreon and set up a Patreon account. It's a great way you can lend financial support to the show. I don't do advertising. If you're so inclined and you feel like you're getting some value in the show, feel free to donate to the show. And you can do that easily at patreon.com/Dose of Leadership, or you can go to my website at doseofleadership.com and click on the Support Us on Patreon banner in the left sidebar or in the menu item, and it's pretty easy. You can donate as much or as little as you want, and again, your support would be greatly appreciated. Again, thank you so much. And last plug before we start the show, if you're needing a speaker, needing a coach, one-on-one coach, a group coach, seminars, speaking, you can find out more at my personal website, richardryerson.com, and you can learn more about my masterminds, my coaching, and my speaking services, all centered around leadership, personal growth, and searching for significance. All right, you're really going to enjoy this conversation with Linda Kaplan Thaler. She really is an advertising genius. She's in the Advertising Hall of Fame. She's a creator of many of some iconic campaigns that you're going to be very familiar with. Most of all, the Aflac duck, that was her idea, right? Toys R Us kid, that's her. Kodak moments. She was the CEO of the Kaplan Thaler Group, which quickly became one of America's fastest growing ad agencies. She's the former chairman of Publix Kaplan Thaler New York and the co-author of several national bestsellers, including Bang, Getting Your Message Heard in a Noisy World, The Power of Nice, The Power of Small, and her most recent book. And the book we're going to talk about primarily on this show, Grit to Great, on how perseverance and passion can take you from ordinary to extraordinary. And man, I got to tell you, I love, love, love this book, Grit to Great. And I love this conversation. You know, the book is, again, about all that grit, perseverance, perspiration, determination, you know, how to the stick-to-itiveness that we all need. You know, we look at people, you know, kind of climbing the corporate ladder or achieving some level of success that we think that, man, there's no way we could do it. They're so talented, but it's not about that. Most people get ahead, even the gifted ones, because they've worked hard. They put in thousands of hours of practice, sweat equity, and they made their own luck. And I think that's so important as to realize and embrace that truth as you go on your leadership journey, that it is all about grit and tenacity. And we hit that hard in this conversation, and I think you're really going to enjoy it. So without further ado, here's Linda Kaplan-Thaler, the author of Grit to Grit. Well, Linda, I'm so excited to have you on Dose of Leadership. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I love, 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 can I say I love Grit to Great? It's one of my favorite go-to books of the past couple of months. Can I just say that on the outset? Is that okay?
Oh, you know, you don't have to twist my arm on that one. actually, we were one of the top business books for 2015, and Ariana Huffington's Christmas list of books to buy. And so we've been thrilled. Robin Covell and I wrote the book together. We've been thrilled with the response so far, and thank you for reading it.
Yeah. It's just such a, you know, a lot of what we talk about or I've talked about on the show for the last 3 years, and certainly in my entrepreneurial and leadership journey, I talk about talent a lot. And part of the thing that resonated with me the most in that book was the part talking about talent. And I say that a lot of times in presentations and in coaching clients, is like, look, talent is a given, but it's never enough. And it's, you know, you got to be talented at something, but we put so much emphasis and stock on talent in this society. But in reality, it's so much more than that. It's just the perseverance, it's the grit, to the tenacity, right? I mean,
that's why Robin and I wrote this book. I mean, we started an ad agency from scratch, and within a couple of years, the Kaplan Thaler Group was literally the fastest growing agency in the United States. And honestly, we were bright, but we're not that bright. And we were talented, but certainly not uber talented. And we started looking around at people who had really made it, you know, really extraordinary people. You know, Walt Disney was apparently fired from his first job because his boss said he lacked imagination. And Colin Powell was a C-minus student.
Right.
And Steven Spielberg couldn't get into film school. And Michael Jordan was cut from his high school varsity basketball. These people were not born with incredible anything.
Right.
And we looked at it and realized none of them had that it factor. They weren't brilliant and didn't have virtuoso talent. They had what we call the grit factor, guts, resilience, initiative, and tenacity. And that's what got them where they were.
You know, I just remember growing up, and you got an example in the book, or you referenced some study they did about gifted students. And I remember I was in the gifted class, and I just remember the emphasis from the parents and the way the school treated them. And it's not like I had a great childhood. I did okay. I was an average student and everything else. But that kind of that and many other examples as you go through is like, well, I never can, or I'm not as good at, you know what I mean? And you start to believe it, and it just kind of breeds this kind of mediocrity, the stagnation that you see all around us. And it's like, if we don't seem to celebrate the, I guess in certain circles we certainly do, but I'm just talking in general, we don't seem to celebrate the up and coming, clawing through the mud, you know, grit story as well as we do, is like, oh my God, this person's just naturally gifted and talented and look how great they are. But even then, the people, the ice grader, the Michael Phelps, I mean, I guess you hear some of the stories, but it's just, we think that, well, they're there because God gifted them with some sort of talent.
Exactly. You know, we did so much research for this book. I mean, 3 years worth of research. And actually, people who are born prodigies, a disproportionate amount of them become actually very, you know, failures, unsuccessful.
Yeah, right.
2% of them actually do anything even closely related to achieving success. Yet 3/4 of the people who do become successful not only have this grit factor, but actually have pretty challenging childhoods. they were average or below average students. They faced poverty. They faced dyslexia. And it's amazing how many of them. We interview Wendy Thomas, who's one of our clients at the agency, is Wendy's, you know, the hamburger chain. Her dad, Dave Thomas, who named the restaurant after her. He had the most abysmal childhood. He had an adoptive mother who died when she was 6 months old. He had an abusive, very difficult childhood. His feet were permanently deformed from wearing shoes that didn't fit. And, you know, he had only had one person in his life, his adoptive grandmother, Minnie, who said, hard work is good for the soul, plus if you're working hard, you don't have time to feel sorry for yourself. And she said, I don't care what you do in life, just do it with quality and never cut corners, which, by the way, is the reason that the Wendy's hamburgers are square, because he's honoring Grandma Minnie and not cutting any corners.
I love that story, and I love the story in the book of how you guys got the Wendy's account. I mean, my stomach was in knots reading it and just kind of putting myself in that situation. But it's a great story because it reminds us that, you know, on the outset, you would think, oh my God, we're competing against all these, you know, large agencies. Here we are, you know, these two women, the smaller agency, we don't have a chance. But you just never believe that. And you went out and you just, even up to the last minute, rehearsing things and, you know, we got an hour left, let's do one more dress rehearsal, whatever.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, that's just amazing.
Exactly. I mean, I think, you know, I've always taken the attitude, it's great to think like an underdog. And we would tell our clients at Procter & Gamble or Wendy's or any of them, I don't care if you're on top, think like an underdog, because if you're standing still, you're going under, because the world is moving so quickly. With Wendy's, we were up against like 50 contenders, and we were so tiny. And even the clients just, you know, they threw us a bone. They never thought we would get it. And because we had that attitude, we weren't prepared. We were like overprepared. We actually worked in the restaurants for a while, you know, learning how to put burgers together. We did sleepovers where the whole agency would just sleep over. We filmed ourselves just sleeping over and working day and night. We made up fake newspaper ads to show that they could finally beat Burger King, which they finally did after we won the account. We got them to the number two chain. And they finally awarded us the account. They said, you know, your work was great, but at the end of the day, we just knew that nobody would work harder than you in our business. And we tell that story because, you know, people just keep thinking that it's all about this brilliant genius or this incredible talent. Michael Bloomberg, our esteemed ex-mayor of New York, is very fond of saying, I will never be the smartest person in the room. He was also a C-minus student like Colin Powell. He said, but I outwork everybody. It isn't about being prepared. We talk in the book, it's about being over-prepared. If you spend 30 minutes a day more on whatever that presentation is or whatever that paper is, you will have put in an extra 130 to 60 hours a year over what the other person is doing. Right. And that's bound to make you a winner.
Yeah, you have no choice. The universe has to move when it sees you putting that kind of effort in, right? And I think that we see such a negative rap on overachievement, or how do I even put this? You see the kid is like, well, they don't have a life. I got to do everything, you know. But just doing that extra 30 minutes or having the discipline habits, it's the discipline consistency, I guess, is the point that I wanted to highlight, is that doing the ordinary things just a little bit better than everybody else is really the difference maker, I think.
It is. And, you know, we actually interviewed Nick Walenda, who, if you recall, part of the Walenda family, they're aerialists and tightrope walkers. And he walked across the Grand Canyon. We even have a chapter called Lose the Safety Net, course, without a safety net. We interviewed him, not while he was on the high wire, of course, after he got off.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, people must think you're crazy. You've got a wife. You've got three kids. You took your life in your hands. He said it was pretty much like, you know, pretty much a cakewalk, because what people don't realize is that I practiced this for 5 years, 8 to 10 hours a day in my backyard under wind currents, sand currents. There was nothing that was happening in the Grand Canyon that I hadn't already done double or triple or quadruple in my backyard. He said, fear is not something you run away from. Fear is something you embrace. Fear tells you, you haven't practiced enough. You haven't worked hard enough.
I love that.
And he also, his great quote from his great grandfather said, always remember, life is on the high wire. everything else is just watching. And I love that. Life
Yeah.
is supposed to feel scary. That's when you're really living. That's when you're really taking a chance and doing something special with your life.
I love that analogy. And I think, I would say the last 8 to 10 years, really coming to appreciate how good of a motivator, or at least a barometer, fear can be. And it's like you get to the point where you actually embrace it, because it really pretty much tells you what you should be doing, I think. You know, that's how I look at it. It's a barometer on probably what I should be working on, because if it's not, then I'm not challenging, I'm not pushing myself, I'm not living life to what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm shaming the angels, like I like to say it, you know?
Yeah, because I'm it is so true. We looked at an interview with this former marathon runner who used to do volunteer work searching for landmines in third world countries in Africa, and literally lost an arm and a leg to an exploding landmine. And everybody thought he was finished. I mean, this was a guy who was an incredible athlete. He got the prosthetic limbs. He went back. He now does these incredible, like, 100-mile marathons. And the interview that we saw with him was so incredible, because he said, what you learn when you do this is that as soon as you get to that point where you say, I just can't go any further, I just can't do any more, he said, you find out that there's a new plateau, mm-hmm. and you reach it. And, you know, they recently did this incredible study with two groups of people. And one group, they were told, you have an hour to come up with 10 ideas for this product. Another group, they said, you have an hour to come up with 10 ideas. You know, they each came up with 10 ideas. The first group, they said, well, do you want to stay a little longer and come up with some more ideas? No. I'm really exhausted. I won't come up with anything better. The second group had to stay for an hour longer, forced to stay for it, came up with 15 more brilliant ideas, better than the original 10. And so it's this example of, every time we look in our research, pushing that, you know, and it isn't about, like you said, it isn't about pushing, you know, like, oh my goodness, I have to give up my life. It's right. just that extra hour, it's right, that right, extra right. 30 minutes, and you'd be amazed how much you can do.
It's that, I don't know a better word for it, but discipline, consistency, or developing those kind of habits of doing that extra push up when, you know, just doing one more, you know, like, okay, I'm doing it. Yeah. You do one, whatever,
Muhammad Ali has a great quote. Someone asked him, how many sit-ups, when he was training, how many sit-ups a day do you do? And he said, I don't know. And the reporter said, wait a second, you don't count how many sit-ups you do? He said, oh, I only start counting when it starts to hurt. He said, because I haven't really done anything until that. And I love that metaphor. Right?
Yeah.
Until it starts to hurt, until you start to feel some of that pain is when you're actually accomplishing something, right?
I love that. That's a great way to look at it, because it's almost like, I don't know, I think we go through life thinking that it is about arriving somewhere, but I've totally resigned that fact that you never fully arrive. And it's like the mountain that you never reach a peak. And like you stop at a base camp every now and then and look at your progress, and we put our arms on each other and drink a glass of wine and say, look how far we've come, and recharge. But the next day we're going at it again, right? I mean,
exactly. I mean, it's amazing that, it really is so much more about the journey than anything else. Pablo Casals, who's arguably one of the best cellists that's ever lived, and certainly the best cellist of the 20th century, was still practicing 4 hours a day when he was well into his 90s.
Right.
And he was interviewed, and somebody said to him, why are you, you're 93 years old, why are you practicing so many hours a day still? And he looked up, and in all, without being pretentious or, you know, not joking around, he said, because I'm beginning to see some improvement. Because he understood that the journey is never over, and it's actually the journey that really is the most fun. You know, we have a chapter in our book that's called Ditch the Dream.
Yeah.
When you live in this world where you're constantly imagining the rosy future, it gets you nowhere. Estee Lauder once said, I never once dreamt of success. I just work for it. And there's a saying, if you want your dreams to become a reality, so wake up already. And, right. And it's when you're in the present, and you know this, you know, when you're in the present and not thinking about this gauzy future where everything's perfect, but solving the problems of the day, you know, those little minutiae, you know, I need to get more bond paper, I maybe need to take another marketing course, I need to make 5 cold calls a day. Doing it bit by bit is really what's going to, as someone once said, you know, it's like walking up Everest with a toothpick. You're eventually going to get there. Right. It's going to take a friggin' long time, but you know what? The fastest growing segment of the population are centenarians, or people in their hundreds. And I love to tell millennials, like, what's your rush? You think you have to get there by the time you're 30? Forget about it. You're going to probably have 3 or 4 or 5 careers. So what?
Yeah.
If it takes you 10 or 15 years, Beverly Sills, amazing opera singer. I love this quote. She says, there are no shortcuts to anywhere worth going. Isn't that the truth?
Oh, yeah. It's so true. And I think some people, when I said it's that never-ending kind of journey, you never arrive. Some people initially, I've had a couple people where we've had some breakthrough coaching moments where we've talked about that, and they seem almost initially depressed, but for me it was like relief. When I finally looked at life that way, it was like a tremendous relief. Does that make sense? Because I have to stop chasing that elusive, mythical whatever.
I know, it makes total sense. And you know, for me, I grew a company from scratch. You know, we were the agency that created that Aflac duck.
Yeah, right.
That, and you know, that quacking.
Yes.
Yeah. Now we made Aflac so popular now that when ducks see other ducks, they immediately think of supplemental insurance. So, you know, we've arrived, and we created, you know, that woman in the shower for herbal essences.
Yeah.
Yes. And back in the day, I wrote the Toys R Us song.
Yep,
I'm a composer, right. And we, you know, and all of those wonderful milestones. And I remember my boss, James Patterson, who I write about in the book, now a very famous author. He said to me, "Are you ever going to stop and just enjoy this moment?" And I said, "I don't know. I'm too fixated on what it is I want to do next, because that's where the fun is." And you know, I formally left the agency business. I built an agency that merged and grew to be a multi-billion-dollar company with hundreds of employees. And I finally took all the awards and I put them on videotape so that my grandchildren might see them one day. And I tossed them in the garbage, because I said that part of my life is done.
Wow.
I want to go back to, you know, theater. I used to be a performer. I want to go back to public speaking and media, which I do now, motivational and teaching talks around the country and the world, espousing the things I believe in, like Grit to Great, or one of my former books that I wrote with Robin Coval, The Power of Nice, things that I believe in,
right,
that I think can be of some benefit to people. And when I, especially when I speak at colleges and they say, "Well, what's your happiest day?" And I look at them in the light in their eyes and I go, "My happiest day is right now, talking to all of you, because maybe it will impact how you think about your future." And it really is true. I mean, my happiest moment is talking to you right now.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the future is going to bring, because I'm too busy concentrating on the present and having a lot of fun.
It is amazing. I just finished up right before this conversation. We had another one. We were talking about the gentleman I was talking with. We were talking about that self-awareness. And I distinctly remember that whenever I chose to – it sounds crazy, but when I chose to opt in to the awareness around me, and I'm not a metaphysical guy. I mean, I'm a spiritual guy, but I don't – does that make – I can't even articulate it right now. But at the moment I realized self-awareness, that I'm just opting into what is happening right now, things dramatically changed for me, dramatically.
It's exactly right, because we spend – and you know, that wonderful book, Power of Now, we spend no time living in the present. Mm-hmm. All our time is spent regretting or bemoaning the past and idealizing a future and not enjoying. And when you just sit and say, "Wow, I'm just enjoying this moment now. Let me just lap it up." Mm-hmm. Because that, honestly, that's all there is. You know, when I worked on Kodak, we helped create, and I'm sure you've heard the term Kodak moments.
Yep.
Because we understood, you know, in branding, you understand it's not about what you buy, but what you buy into and what that brand does and the role it plays in your life. And once we realize that Kodak was not just about beautiful, colorful film, competing with price point for Fuji, whoever the competitor was, but actually preserving the now, preserving what was happening at that moment, knowing that it's never going to exist again, but someday you can look back on it. And that's what it's all about, is just preserving the now as much as you can, with the hopes one day that you look back on it and go, you know what, I'm really glad I enjoyed that moment, even if it was something that was hard fought, even if it was something that was negative, that feeling of, but I got through it, I did it. You know, when either any one of my kids struggle through something, I always say, but how did you feel afterwards? You know, Mom, I felt great.
Yeah.
I felt great.
That's why I think there's so much value into being in that mud moment. I call them mud moments, and I have another show.
I love that.
I have another show called Out of the Mud where we talk about that, but when you get out of it, because it's so powerful, and I think it's important to understand that you do have the choice, even when you're in that mud moment, you have the choice to do something. You may not like your choices, but you have the power to choose something. And when you eventually do get out of the mud, you're different. You know, when you wash it off, I mean, it's different. You feel different. You are different. You're transformed. And even if the mud stays in your cuticles and in the crevices of your hands, I mean, it reminds you of where you came from. I think that, I don't know, I just love that metaphor, because it's so, there's great value. It's a blessing. Well, you know, and even if in the Bible even talks about that, you know, be thankful for this, you know, moment that you're in, because when you come out, you're different and you're better for it. I don't know.
I totally agree. You know, years ago I had cancer, and my mother had gone through breast cancer, and thankfully is 92 and she's doing fine. And I went through it at a very early age. I was 39. I hadn't had children yet. I thought my life is over.
Right.
And my mother, who's the strongest human being I know, my mother said to me, I wish I could go through this for you, but I can't. You're going to go through this alone, and you're going to get through to the other side. And when you do, you are going to feel so powerful. Everything else in life is going to be gravy. And you know, I did go through it, and I went on to have two children against all odds. They told me I wouldn't be able to, and I did. My son is 24, getting his PhD at Harvard. My daughter's composer, like my husband, now in college herself. And two miracles that never were supposed to happen. But I started my own agency soon afterwards. And when anything bad would happen with the agency, you know, we'd lost a client, my mother would say to me, well, do you have cancer again? And I said, no. And she said, well, what are you worried about? And I would laugh. And I tell people, I wouldn't wish that on anybody. But when you go through a life and death struggle, it is somewhat of a gift. Mm-hmm. You know, part of the gift is you can help, and I've helped so many women have gone through it, and I've been able to help them through it. But it is a gift that God gives you and says to you, you know what, you're going to get through this. And boy, are you going to appreciate life on the other side. Yeah. I once wrote a poem saying it's like we're dancing in this ballroom, and we have no awareness that we're dancing. We're just gliding through life, and then suddenly you hit an abyss. In my case, it was cancer. And you almost are about to fall, and you suddenly realize that you're not going to fall. Well, now when you dance, the music is sweeter. Your partner holds you closer, and everything in that dance is just more beautiful, and you enjoy it so much more.
Yeah, I love that. It's all about the perspective.
Yep.
It's all about the perspective. And I think that, I don't know, it's making that shift and that transition. And I mean, and that's why leadership is so important to me, because it gets to the root element of all this. It's so easy to understand, but it takes authenticity, transparency, and courage to really lead that fulfilling life, and the willingness to, I don't know, even when you're in that mud moment, to just understand that this too shall pass. I don't know how, I mean, we're all in it at some point. We're all going to be in it again, but just having that awareness of that it will pass and that you will be transformed the other end is what keeps me going anyway.
You know, a very wise man once said to me when I was going through a very, very difficult time in my life, there was a painting in his office, and he said, I want you to walk up to this painting, and I want you to put your nose on it. He said, what do you see? And I said, I don't know. I just see a bunch of some colored dots. He said, yeah, I know. That's all you see. Now I want you to walk back. And now what do you see? I see, wow, I see a beautiful stream and rocks and trees. He said, well, that's how I see your life. Mm-hmm. He said, but you don't see it that way now because you're in that, you call it the mud moment, you know, mm-hmm. and that's what it was for me. He said, you see that moment. He said, but I see all the dips and turns. And you know, you can't really have a joyous moment until you've experienced a bad moment.
It's right, because right, you can't.
Otherwise you have no perspective. None. And by the way, you know, in the Talmud, you know, I'm of Jewish persuasion, and there is nothing about happiness. Really, you are put on this earth for one reason, is to make it a better place. So when you die, you've left it a better place than the way that you found it.
Right.
And it's all about, and by the way, you know, the Bible, none of the Bibles, we consulted all sorts of religious leaders, talks about the word retirement. About right. And you know, I looked it up, and Robert and I researched, it was an invented term during the Industrial Age, simply because machines were doing so much work, they mm-hmm. had to get older people out of the workplace to make room for younger people to have jobs. So they invented this term. And when people turned 60 or 65, they gave them a watch, and that was it. And the research is actually showing that when people retire and do nothing, they're incredibly depressed, because the Bible teaches us that we were meant to keep working and to keep helping others until we could no longer do it. And so even if you leave a specific job, you know, when you're 65, isn't it kind of the joy you feel of creating some other job that can maybe help other people? I mean, happiness is not the absence of problems.
Yeah.
And we talked to a neurologist about this. Happiness is how you feel when you solve problems.
Right.
Right?
Yep.
And when we use our grit for good, which is how we close the book, that's when we feel our happiest.
Well, and I think that's what our obligation is. I mean, to your point, I really do think that is what we are charged to do with the limited time that we're here. Because, you know, if there's something that's making your stomach in knots or your throat tight, God, you better be listening to that to see what it is, because something profound is going to happen the other side of it. And I just think that's what we're called to do. I mean, otherwise. Yeah, and that, I think you brought up the Industrial Revolution. You know, that whole Frederick Winslow Taylor scientific management theory mindset. Just, I mean, we're still seeing the ramifications of it. You know, to the point to where we think and we have to go to college to. I mean, college is great and it's good, but we're kind of programmed thinking that you cannot have a successful life unless you follow these set of rules and that you have a certain amount of money by the time you're 65. And it's just, I think that's just a sad way to look at life.
It's so interesting. I mean, a lot of the people we hire in our company never went to college. The CEO of the company I just left never went to college. You know, brilliant people, and it wasn't right for them. And Google doesn't even look to see if you went to college or where you went to college. They've just taken it off. They ask you to take it off the resume because it's not really accounting for who you really are or what you've accomplished in life.
Yeah.
And I tell people, and I speak to colleges around the country, the first thing I say to them is, by the way, you're not that special.
Yeah, I love that.
You know, it was during this whole self-esteem movement in the last 20 years, we were told to tell our kids that they were brilliant and unique and wonderful, and each was born incredibly, incredibly special and genius. And and it just created a whole generation that didn't understand, for the large part, that it really was about your work ethic. It was about your stamina and your perseverance and the passion you felt for something. And I hate it because, you know, a lot of these people come into jobs and they think, you know, that I went to an Ivy League school, so I shouldn't be doing this job. It's too lowly of me. And I go, you know what? Look at the schools that the CEOs of the top Fortune 100 companies went to, and most of them you never heard of.
Right.
Never heard of.
Right.
They weren't Ivy League schools.
Mm-hmm. You're so true. I mean, well, and Jim Collins highlights it in Good to Great, which, not to be confused with Grit to Great, by the way, but but he talks about that, about those level five leaders, the ones that are really, truly special that leave lasting legacy, that make the campsite better than they found it. You know, they are the ones that you never hear about. And it's because they've got this kind of weird combination, or not weird, rare combination of high level intensity, and the intensity is geared towards making the place better. But they're humble at the same time, right? It's like this humility, exactly. And this intensity of will, and combined with this humility, and all the great leaders that we're talking about that I want to emulate, or that I look up to, share those. You know, they're, like I said, they're making the world or the campsite better than they found it. But
yeah, a lot of them are. You don't know who they are.
Yeah,
I was
exactly.
just reading in the paper, or there was actually a documentary about this world class pianist who just did not like audiences. He got terrible anxiety. So he did like one concert. He got rave reviews, and now he's in his 80s. He's a piano teacher, and he lives this very sedentary life. And he said, "I'm just so happy. I'm just so happy not performing, and just playing piano for myself and teaching others." And he's a completely unknown person,
right?
And he's so incredibly at peace with himself, right? You sometimes wish, I wish more of those people really did want to become political leaders.
I know it.
You know, what a world we'd have, right?
I know. We're just so surrounded by this. Is this the best we can do, really? I mean, come on. You know?
Don't get me started.
I know. Don't get me started. We don't want to turn to political debate. But you know what? I mean, just everywhere you look, the things that are celebrated, at least that, not so much celebrated, at least we're bombarded with, when you really strip it away, is mediocre. At best.
Yeah.
And dysfunctional too. But I mean, it's just, you know what I mean? It's like the real heroes that are making like that, the example you gave me with the piano teacher. I mean, look at I bet you when he dies, there will be so many people at his funeral with all the people that he, you know what I mean? The impact and the legacy that he's laying,
exactly.
And no one even knows about him.
You know, we interviewed this woman in the book who's completely unknown. She's watching TV one day. Her husband happened to be from Tanzania, and she notices that all these people, these children in Tanzania, are starving. They're malnourished. And she turns to her husband, and this is a woman who had 5 kids and no business degree, nothing. And she said, "We have to help. We have to help these children." It's like, what? And she looked up and she found there was this thing called Plumpy Nut, which is sort of like a peanut butter based product, doesn't need refrigeration. She said, "We got to figure out how to open up a Plumpy Nut factory in Tanzania." What? And it took her years. And she's raising the 5 kids, and they raised money, and they had to go through all of these international rules and regulations to start this. Anyway, 4 years later, she opens up this factory in Tanzania. They opened up 3 more. They fed, now they have these factories around the world. They have fed over, I don't know, 5 million children are alive today because of these Plumpy Nut, this product that they put on bread. And she's a nobody. You never heard of her.
Yeah.
And she doesn't care. And that's why we wanted to interview her, talk about somebody with grit. And she said, no, no applause, nothing. I just had to do something. And I tell people whenever I speak, never think for a minute you don't have the power to change one life, 2 lives,
Amen.
A million lives. I don't care where you went to school. I don't care what your education is. If you've got the grit, you can make it happen. It's humanity's great equalizer. Anybody, and we have lots of grit tips in the book and grit builders. Anybody can develop it, whether you're 8 or 88. Just make a decision what you want to do with it and go for it.
I love that. Love it. It's so true. And just the fact that, you know, she was sitting on the couch and made that decision. I'm suspending the belief in how this is going to get done. I just know this has to get done somehow.
And I'm the one that's going to do it because no one else will do it.
Right. And then, you know, screw all those resistance and the other part of the people, you know, the negative self-talk. And I'm sure she had it at some point. It said, "Oh, what are you doing? You're crazy." You know, even the closest ones, the loved one, "Honey, this is insane. You got 5 kids. We can't," you know. And it's just, you got to just keep working through. That's what the grit comes in.
You know, this is a story we talk about, one of our other books, Power of Small, the power of making small talk. And we actually did a little film on this, The Power of Small Talk. It's on YouTube. We found this woman in Tacoma, Washington. She's a barista, a woman who's in her mid-50s. And every day, this other woman, you didn't even know her name, would come in and have a cup, you know, order a cup of coffee. But she did something different than all the other people online. She would actually talk to the barista, ask her how her day was, how she was feeling. She liked to make small talk. She liked to make the barista feel important and not just some commoditized person who, you know, I have to wait online for. And one day the woman walks in and the barista notices that she doesn't look good and she looks very upset. "What's the matter?" she asks her. "Well, I have kidney failure. I just found out that nobody in my family is a blood match and I'm going on dialysis soon. They don't really give me much time to live." And she reached over, she took her hand and she said, "I'm going to get tested for you." Well, there's got to be a being, right? A greater right. being on earth mm-hmm. or above earth. Mm-hmm. She was a perfect match.
Wow.
She didn't know the woman's name, so she had to wait till she saw her, you know, a couple of weeks later. She donated her kidney.
Oh, my God.
They become best friends. Her husband said, "I don't mind you doing things for people, but please don't give away any more body parts. You know, you have that one kidney." Anyway, they not only became best friends, and we did a little film about them, but and they both have grandchildren now. She's the woman who had got the kidney and whose life was saved said, "You have given me a gift that is unbelievable." But the barista said to her, "No, I got the greater gift because you made me feel like somebody when I didn't feel that important in my life.
Wow.
And now I feel like I'm 100 feet tall." So, you know, when you give, you know, that, of course, is the greatest gift. And by the way, neurologist has told us that when you give to somebody, the same part of your brain lights up as when you're given money or when you give somebody a kiss.
Wow.
We are hardwired to want to help each other. That's why we still exist as a human species.
And I love these. I love those examples. I love these stories. I mean, it's the whole reason why I do this show. I love hearing that. I love exactly everything that you do. I'm curious, though. Let me go back. How, you know, growing up, you grew up in New York City when you were a kid in the 50s?
I grew up in the Bronx.
In the
yeah.
Bronx.
A place of, you know, no Ivy League.
Yeah.
No Ivy League scholars there, you know.
What was that like? What were your parents like? What was the childhood like? What was it like growing up in the Bronx in the 50s and the 60s?
Well, I won't. I could easily get back to talking like I talked in the Bronx, but I think it would. You think your readers, your listeners, would be very upset. Actually, I had a kind of a boring childhood, but a wonderful childhood. Right? That's the best kind.
Yeah.
Middle class parents. Just my mother was a homemaker. My father and my mother was a terrific writer too. My father worked tirelessly. You know, it's so interesting. I tell this story. When I do my talks about my dad, when he was one of the earlier inventors of the parts of the TV set, he invented part of the wiring, and he was an electrical engineer. And I talk in the book about not retiring but rewiring. And when he was in his 90s, him and my mom, you know, moved to an independent living facility, and he asked people, "What can I do to make your life better? Do you want me to give you lectures on technology?" And they said, "You know, Marvin, we're in our wheelchairs, we're in our 90s, we don't laugh enough, we want to laugh more." So every month he would just gather, he knew that they weren't on the internet, you know, they mm-hmm. weren't internet savvy, he would gather things from the internet, YouTube clips of Saturday Night Live and Carol Burnett and, you know, Woody Allen, and he'd put them together as clips, and they would just laugh in their wheelchairs for an hour, and it was just called the Laugh with Marvin Workshops. And up until the time that he passed away in September at 95 years of age,
wow.
Do you know, a week before he passed away, he said to me, "But I still have clips that I want to show."
Oh, man.
And I want to gather those clips together and have a memorial service next year and just gather the residents together and said, "These were the clips that he never got to show you." He was still trying to make people's lives better. And I think that's why he lived as long as he did. He just loved to bring joy into people's lives, no matter how hard it and how hard he worked at it.
I love that story. I guess I would ask, you know, always ask, whose shoulders are you standing on? But I can just see that you're standing on your mother and your father's shoulders.
Yeah, that's the truth.
Anybody else?
I think it mostly came from my parents and the wonderful role models I've met, you know, along the way, too numerous to imagine. I did get to interview Warren Buffett once for a radio campaign, and I was told I only had 10 minutes with him, and he is such an unpretentious, kind man, as you know, you've seen him in interviews. Mm-hmm. And I know I had 10 minutes, but I also did my reading. I'm a gritty person, and I looked up and saw that Cherry Coke is his favorite product. Mm-hmm. That's what he loves, that drink, mainly because, I don't know, maybe because he's made billions of dollars in Coca-Cola stock. And before we started the interview, I said, Mr. Buffett, I just want to give you a gift. And I gave him this $1 can of Cherry Coke to this man who's worth billions. And he turned to me and he said, young lady. And of course, I was flattered that he called me young. And he said, in all my years being interviewed, no one has ever given me my favorite beverage. So what I'm going to do is cancel all my meetings this morning and give you an interview that'll last as long as you need me.
Oh my God, that's great.
And I had a 2-hour interview with Warren Buffett.
Oh my God, that's awesome.
I call it, you know, sweetening the deal. We talk about that in The Power of Nice. Sweetening the deal. It just cost me a dollar.
That is awesome. That is an awesome story.
Yeah, he's a great role model for me and everybody.
Well, gosh, I love your stuff. I could talk to you for hours. There's so many things I want to learn from you. I want to talk with you about. You got to come back on the show. There's so many other things.
I'd love to. Thank you.
How can people get in touch with you, interact with you, engage with you?
Well, you can follow me at Twitter at Linda Thaler 2, LindaThaler2, the number 2. Facebook, Linda K. Dot Thaler, Thaler. And I am at Linda, my email address, Linda@ThalerProductions.com. The book is anywhere. It's audio book. And thankfully, I'm not doing it. It's an actress doing it. Robin Covell and I, of course, wrote the book. It's in its fourth printing. It's a bestseller. And anybody that's interested in buying can get it anywhere, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, iBooks. And really, if there's anyone out there that would like to have me come speak, I speak at corporations, colleges, and anywhere you think you might think this message would be appropriate, I'd love to come out and pay a visit. And I just want to thank everybody for listening. And thank you for such an extraordinary interview, Richard. Really wonderful.
Well, it's my pleasure. And like I said, I was looking forward to this one. And I read Grit to Great, and I came across – I was telling you in the pre-recording, we were talking about how I came across your name in a John Maxwell book, his latest book. And I was like – and I just started digging. I'm like, oh, my gosh, how did I not know about all this great material that you're putting out there? And Grit to Great is – it's just – it's a go-to for me. And there's – a handful of books that I consider go-tos, and I'm going to consider Grit to Great one of those. And I just love that book, and I'm anxious to dive into the rest of your work. And I'm so honored and happy to have met you. And I look forward to staying in touch with you.
Thank you so much, Richard. Have a great day, everybody listening.
Richard invites you to become a part of the Dose of Leadership community. Visit doseofleadership.com and sign up to receive his free Common Sense Leadership ebook, a guide that highlights how all of us can learn to become calm, confident, consistent, and courageous in all aspects of our lives. Richard is also available as a speaker for your next event. Richard specializes in practical leadership and change management. He has a philosophy of inspiring everyone to think and act like a leader, which is based on timeless natural principles and common sense. You can get more info by visiting doseofleadership.com.
Some people might say coffee doesn't need chocolate, but you're not some people. You're a dreamer. You see the possibilities of chocolate and caramel flavors swirling together with cold brew, topped with velvety chocolate cold foam and cocoa caramel crumbles. That imagination can only be rewarded with Dunkin's new caramel chocolate cold brew. It's a cold brew dream come true. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.